You're listening to Mockingbird. This recording was made at the 8th Annual Mockingbird Conference, held at Calvary St. George's Church in New York City.
Can everyone hear me? Can you hear the fear in my heart? No, I'm just kidding. It's not really there. You can't hear it. So maybe what I should do is just give a brief intro. My name is Jeremy. I'm a parishioner here at Calvary St. George's Church. And to my right is Dr. James Romaine, an art historian who's also my former professor at a program called NICAMS, which was an art program here in New York. And we're here to talk about the theology of false absolution in Christian kitsch. And maybe this is really, the format is really supposed to be a conversation, so it's going to be an informal presentation, but we are really interested in hearing your thoughts and reactions and questions you may have. And so maybe a good, great place to start, James, is by just talking about the title a little bit. What is kitsch, maybe, just as a beginning point, and also why would you accuse it of being some kind of false absolutory visual art?
Sure. Thank you all for coming this afternoon. Let's start with an image here. And when I show something like this, I sort of feel like I'm shooting fish in a barrel with, initially the term, to answer your question, initially the term kitsch developed out of the Industrial Revolution, where imagery and objects, et cetera, were being mass-produced mechanically, and it was a response to the loss of handmade objects. And that's sort of how the idea of kitsch initially developed in the first half of the 20th century. Today, in the age of digital media, that original definition of kitsch really no longer is as useful as it was. So the way in which I'm using the word kitsch here is really not so much a question of whether something is handmade or mass-produced, but rather in terms of the visual language that is developed by the artist. And so when we look at a work here by Thomas Kincaid, Thomas Kincaid has developed a very specific and unique and intentional visual language that communicates something. So I guess one of the foundational presuppositions that I'm operating from to sort of share with you what my ideas are, one of the foundational presuppositions is that in a work of art, the work of art communicates not only by what it depicts, but also how it depicts. The visual language that the artist develops with which to communicate their subject is as important as the iconography or motifs that they develop. Often when we look at art, we simply look at the subject matter and we say, oh, that's a painting of some houses by the river, or that's a painting of a horse, or whatever. And we engage the work primarily through its subject matter.
Or that's a painting of Jesus, and therefore it's a Christian work of art.
Yeah, so that's what makes this work Christian, is it's a painting of Jesus, right? It has to be Christian, right? Because it's a painting of Jesus, right? When we begin to look at the visual language that Thomas Kincaid develops here, it's a visual language that is essentially empty. It's a visual language that promises what it won't deliver. And it's a visual language that is a very shallow pool. And so what makes this work kitsch is the visual language that it's advancing. I would say similarly, the Warner Salmon, who's a very well-known artist, and then I also have another work here by Warner Salmon, Christ in Gethsemane, is similarly kitsch for the same reason, that it advances principally through its visual language a kind of false theology of you know, a Christ without suffering. I mean, and I've picked the work here by Warner Solomon, in which Christ, of all of Warner Solomon's images, this is the one that in which Christ is most suffering, and he looks slightly disappointed, or so someone once said he kind of looks constipated. But I don't want to be rude about it. But the visual language that Warner Solomon is developing here communicates something that I think, in fact, goes contrary to the image that he's trying to depict with that visual language. And so there's an inconsistency here versus, just to his credit, with Kincaid. There is, in fact, a consistency between the subject matter he's looking to depict and the visual language that he's using to depict it. So in that sense, there's more of a connection between the subject and language here.
Can you expand on that? What's the consistency with Kincaid's subject and visual language? Just briefly.
Sure. Well, in both cases, they're communicating a kind of false a false hope. Like to begin to connect this to the theme of the conference. When you look at this image, you can ask yourself, this painting is almost surrealist. There's a famous painting I should have brought it in by a Belgian artist named Magritte, in which the top half of the painting, the sky is daytime and the street is at night. But when you look at this painting, you say, well, what time is it here? Well, the sky looks fairly bright, and yet all the lights are on, and apparently all the houses are on fire. Because, I mean, when you look in the windows, really, that's the only way that you could really get that kind of light consistently throughout the entire house is if it was on fire. And people don't really think about that when they look at the work. They look, oh, that looks really bright and nice. But it really doesn't work.
But why is that a bad thing? Why do I care that, you know, the houses should be dimmer or something? Or
sure,
I don't want to spend too much time on,
sure,
on the bad stuff. But
sure. Well, the thing then is, I guess I can sometimes compare it to food. Like, it's like eating at McDonald's every day. Like, from time to time, you know, you might want to get, you know, some, go and, you know, have a Big Mac,
fish fillet.
But like, it's actually unhealthy to feed yourself on this kind of false imagery. It doesn't challenge you spiritually, and it doesn't encourage you in the right way.
It's not actually speaking truth.
That's correct.
Through the language it's actually utilizing as an image.
That's exactly right. It doesn't speak the truth. Now, one of the things that people really are attracted to Kincaid's work about is the idea of beauty, and that people want beauty in their life, and I applaud that. So I guess in terms of this, moving on from Kincaid, I wanted to sort of begin by discussing the question, what is beautiful? What is beauty? And so to start that, I wanted to bring in here a drawing by Vincent van Gogh. Now, this is a drawing that Vincent van Gogh made of a man that he met in The Hague, a tired old veteran. And from the looks of him, I think he probably doesn't have any teeth. The way in which his cheeks are all sunken in. He's not a good-looking man. And yet, when you look at, before I was talking about the relationship between the subject depicted and the means by which the subject is depicted, the tenderness with which Vincent draws this man's face is graceful and loving. And when you look at this work, this man is in fact beautiful because that's how Vincent sees him. When Vincent looks at this man, he sees this man as beautiful and is able to use the visual language of his art to communicate that beauty that he sees in this man.
That sounds like a familiar mechanism, speaking as a Christian anyway, that there's some that there's some kind of, you know, Vincent as an artist is imputing some kind of beauty that he sees as being true about this person. Just as a Christian, Christ imputes to us his righteousness, because as he sees us as we are, in light of his love for us.
Exactly. Now, in his paintings, Vincent also does something similar. As he developed as an artist, one of the things that Vincent really wanted to do was make paintings that brought joy and a sense of comfort into people's lives. And this is why I'm contrasting Vincent van Gogh and Thomas Kincaid, because Vincent van Gogh sets out to do a project that is on paper, very similar to what Thomas Kincaid would be saying about his own work, that Kincaid's defense would be, well, I'm making paintings that people look at and it gives them pleasure. It gives them a sense of comfort. And Vincent van Gogh is setting out to do a very similar mission, but he's going about it very differently. In this case, what we have in this painting is a painting of a sower, and the sower is going through the field, and he's sowing seeds, and you can see some of the seeds that are falling out of his hand there, and as he's moving through the landscape, the sun is setting behind him. And if you notice how the sun is setting behind him and the collapse of spatial distance that occurs in the painting, the sun becomes a kind of halo around the sower's head. So once again, just as we saw with the drawing of the old man, when Vincent sees this anonymous poor farmer out in the field doing his work, he sees a saint. He sees a sense of divine blessing, a sense of divine presence permeating through the landscape, and he visualizes that in his use of color. The way in which the colors radiate through the painting communicate the presence of this divine grace permeating through the world. But in Vincent's case, both of these works, he's able to communicate that without denying the reality of suffering in the world, right? One of the problems with Thomas Kincaid is Thomas Kincaid can only do what he does if he starts from a position that denies, first of all, suffering in the world, and also, in fact, Kincaid has actually said this, he wants to paint the world as if the fall never happened. And the problem with that is, if the fall never happened, then there's no need for Christ.
But buy my paintings.
Sure, that's something else.
Because you need that.
But I'm not as concerned with the economic issues of, you know, Thomas Kincaid selling paintings or Vincent selling paintings. I'm really just looking at the work for what they are.
Something else that I think correlates nicely with this work in particular is that this is an image, as James pointed out a moment ago, of a kind of an average scene with an average, very average, or less than average person going about their daily vocation. And through Van Gogh's eyes and visual language, he actually attributes that person's sainthood in a way, which correlates, I think, very directly with Luther's doctrine of vocation, in that there is a promise by God through the gift of the Holy Spirit to work in and through our lives, through the everyday and the normal. And I wonder, I don't know if we're getting too off track about this, James, but there's something also about death and resurrection in this work in particular, particularly the fact that there's a sower sowing seeds into the ground, and how, you know, unless a seed goes into the ground and dies, like, it can't actually, life cannot happen. And I wonder if you could briefly talk about how that actually functions in this painting.
So you're going to make me get up?
I mean, if you want to.
Okay, so the way in which this painting operates in terms of a composition is that in a painting, we tend to read a painting from left to right, especially in Western and European painting, we read from left to right, starting from the lower left, and as we read it, Vincent actually immediately grabs us by the shirt collar and throws us down. The whole composition, once we reach this figure, is moving diagonally off the painting. Now, for the most part, that's disastrous for a composition. The artist never wants you to leave the painting. But Vincent is such an accomplished painter that he's actually able to move you off the painting and then grab you and pull you back into the painting through the device here of the tree. And so what he's doing there compositionally is he is actually taking you along with the seed and burying you in the ground and raising you back up through the tree.
Just one of the reasons I kind of latched onto this painting when I learned what it was actually doing was that that's Van Gogh using the material of paint achieves a visual death and resurrection, just as God using the material of Christ achieves a spiritual death and resurrection.
And you know, Vincent was someone who knew his Bible, and so I think here he's drawing on several different biblical passages. There's obviously the parable of the sower, but there's also a passage where the Apostle Paul specifically says that unless a seed falls into the ground and dies, it can't be raised again. So Vincent knew his Bible well, and, you know, is probably alluding to some of those things here.
And I kind of like, we're spending a lot of time on this, but I kind of like, too, that there's, the seed kind of goes off the painting, and I'm only just kind of realizing this now. We don't get to see what happens between the re-entry, like, between the death and the life. And I kind of find that profound, and another level of success that this image operates on. There's a mystery kind of there.
One of the things that we were talking about was Vincent's use of the sun and the light and color in his painting. And here, one of the artists that Vincent really admired was Rembrandt. And so I kind of wanted to bring Rembrandt in because he's an artist who's using, in fact, biblical subjects. So I don't want to set up this false contrast between that artists can't use biblical subjects. Here we see Rembrandt using the subject of Peter's denial. And I really love the way in which this young girl is holding a candle, which is concealed by her hand. The flame of the candle is behind her hand, and it's illuminating her index finger as it's pointing at Peter. And the other thing that I really love about the painting is Peter's hand is doing two things. One, his hand is out gesturing like this. And initially, that's sort of like, just leave me alone. Like he's shaking her off, to quote a contemporary song. But the other beautiful thing about it is the way in which his hand is directly below Christ. There's a figure there in the background who's being dragged away, who's looking back over his shoulder. And it's as if Christ is looking back over his shoulder in this moment. And since Christ has already foretold that this event was going to happen, it's like Christ is looking back at this moment and is already forgiving Peter for this. And Peter's hand is, they are open to receive Christ, the sort of forgiveness that's coming from Christ. So that open hand there, I read it in two different ways. So this is a painting that involves true or biblical, a biblical sense of absolution, a biblical sense of, you know, sin and forgiveness. Another painting by Rembrandt that is, again, on the same theme of sin and forgiveness is the famous painting of The Return of the Prodigal Son. And a lot has been written about the way in which the father is embracing the returning son, and certainly that's an important part of the painting. But one of the things that's always struck me about this painting is not the returning son who's kneeling before the father, but rather the other brother who's standing there looking down at his brother in kind of judgment. But when you look at this, this is another composition in which, you know, Rembrandt is doing something that an artist really shouldn't do, and yet being able to pull it off. He has divided his composition into two parts and has a vacant space in the middle, which again is usually death for a painting. But in this case, Rembrandt is able to pull it off because somewhere to what would be our left, our upper left, the light source in the painting is entering the painting from our upper left. And you can tell that especially by the shadow that falls across the father's face, right? The father's, what would be on our right side of the father's face, is in shadow. And the light is coming down. And the way in which the same light source captures not only the father and the returning son, but also catches the older brother's face, unites them compositionally, but also unites them in the same grace, that the grace that is available to the one brother is also available to the other. Before we jump into modern art, do you want to say anything else about Rembrandt, or do you want to get into contemporary art?
Something we spoke about not too long ago also, which I don't think is a new idea for anybody, but like Rembrandt wasn't like a particularly holy person. He, and James, you know much more about this than I do, but he was very, you know, had his own struggles and was a sinful person. But as evidenced from his paintings, just as you were saying a second ago, James, he was very aware of the concept of grace and the idea of its power to extend beyond our sin, and for that absolution to actually be absolute.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. So the next artist that I wanted to talk about was a modern artist, a 20th century artist named Francis Bacon. And this is a painting that's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's a triptych, three-part self-portrait of Bacon. And if you don't know anything about Bacon, Francis Bacon the artist, because there's also Francis Bacon the scientist, who's a completely different person. But Francis Bacon the painter was an atheist, and truly he didn't believe in God at all. And he was a drunkard and a gambler and a homosexual. And I mean, when you go down the checklist, right, of things that would not make him a good Christian artist, he would fit them all, right? So, but the thing that strikes me about his paintings is that he's also, at least for my money, one of the best painters of the 20th century. His capacity to apply paint to canvas has such integrity, has such truth to it, that he's able to communicate something that to me is much more truthful and therefore much more gospel than what I find in the work, say, of Thomas Kincaid.
Where you might say, James, the material that Bacon is using, it's himself, he's able to manipulate it to articulate a truth that, regardless of his own life and personal behavior, speaks truth versus through its actual, you know, manifestation on the canvas, as opposed to Kincaid's work, where the actual way in which he applies paint to the canvas and the subject and concept he depicts, despite himself claiming to be a Christian or being a Christian, doesn't, and actually says not the truth, but lies to you.
Exactly. And I mean, Jeremy, you and I were looking at this painting at the Met yesterday, and one of the things that I was pointing out, when I look at this painting, I can interrogate this painting sort of brushstroke by brushstroke and ask each brushstroke what it's doing in the painting. What is its place? What is its role in the painting? And every brushstroke has an answer. Every brushstroke carries significance. He's able to make every touch of the canvas, every time the brush touches the canvas, he's able to make that mean something. And just by, I put Kincaid back in here again because I knew we'd get back to him here, that the opposite is the case here. Every brushstroke in this painting is a lie. Every brushstroke in this painting is, and here I'm not even talking about the subject matter, I'm talking about the mark on the canvas, right? Every brushstroke in this painting is applied without integrity. And so therefore, to me, this painting by Bacon is just much more honest.
Could you expand on that a little bit more, James? I mean, it's difficult because the art isn't in front of us, the actual art, but
yeah.
If you go back to Kincaid for a moment, because I feel like I'm still kind of grasping this myself, actually, but it's almost as if you kind of ask the marks in the painting, you know, why are you here? And the mark either says to you, well, I'm here because I need to be here, or it kind of runs and hides and says, oh, I didn't actually, you know, I wasn't doing anything important. And Kincaid's work, when asked that question, his marks have a very poor answer compared to the work of Bacon, where his actual brush strokes, you know, depict something that has integrity, and every mark that is there, if we could go back to Bacon for a minute, needs to be there to represent what it's representing, despite the fact that the faces themselves, you know, aren't quote-unquote representational, you know. Just because it's not a photographic, realistic painting, there's something truthful in the cheek on the left-hand side of the triptych, where every tone and color mixed together to form the volume of that cheek and the muscle needs to be there for the visual integrity of the painting to work.
I mean, it's similar to if you could imagine in your mind and Photoshop something in or out. Like, for example, if you look at the river, there are lights reflected in the river, and those lights don't really seem to correspond very well to the lights. Where those lights are coming from are not very clear, because the houses and the lampposts are fairly well set back from the river. So how those lights are reflected in the river isn't really true. Or I'll give you another example to compare to a portrait. When you look at this head and you look at where the highlights are, if you look at Christ's forehead, right at the what would be his left, right? I mean, his right, our left. There's a big bright spot on his head. In order for his head to have that kind of bright spot, he would need to have like a baseball-sized welt on the side of his head. Right here. Like a baseball-sized welt on the side of his head, right? So those brush marks, that paint there it's lying. From here, we were going to transition into Koons and the issue of Kitsch. So
sure.
before we do that, like, this is the end of the discussion of painting. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about painting?
Well, I guess for me, something that's significant about this triptych by Bacon, who is an outspoken, you know, atheist and doesn't believe anything about, or didn't believe anything about Christianity, that there's still something, like when I see these paintings, I'm actually deeply moved in a way that when I see a Kincaid painting, there's not the possibility of that, because of the truth that Bacon is that his work embodies. You know, I think these images in particular are very effective at asking questions of existence and the struggle of daily life. And I think that the way that Bacon uses paint to ask that question and to express that struggle is particularly successful. In the way in which it almost seems as though, like, just looking at the image on the left, you know, the figure's head, on the one hand, you could even say that it looks like it's being eaten, or it's being consumed by something, and the thing that's consuming it is darkness. And so there's this, you know, kind of almost nihilistic thought of, you know, are we anything more than just meat? Are we just sentient meat? Another way to look at it also, which I think you can see in all three, is we're kind of in the middle of a moment. We're in an in-between place where he's either moving toward a light source and becoming brighter, or receding into the background and becoming darker, which I think existentially also kind of carries a weight to it, where, you know, am I being extinguished, or am I being kind of brought to life? I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to that, James. But.
Yeah, well, you know, when we were looking at this painting yesterday, you were asking if I saw any hope in it. And I was actually thinking about that again last night. And I think for me, because again, with great art, every detail matters. Right, and that's one of the things that, by definition, makes it a great work of art, is that the artist is able to make every detail matter. I think, Jeremy, if we took this triptych and we rearranged the parts so that the center was still the center, but we flipped the two outside panels, I think it would be a very different painting. To have that darkness on the outside, I think, would make the painting considerably more hopeless. But the fact that the darkness is being contained by the light, to me, is the sort of remnants of hope in the painting. But I think if you took the panels and rearranged them, it would be a very different experience.
The triptych form is also significant too.
Yes. Because, I mean, the triptych form in Western art immediately conjures Christian religious iconography, and Bacon very often used the triptych format. So we were looking at this work and talking about what, at the beginning, what was kitsch, what makes something kitsch. And I think another answer to that question is desire, that kitsch is about desiring things, and not just desiring things, because we all desire things, but giving into that desire in an unhealthy way and letting the desire control us, you know, reaching a point where rather than, and this can be extended to any kind of thing, like again with food, like not just thinking about food in terms of, okay, what is healthy food for us, or what is, you know, enjoyable food for us, because God wants us to enjoy his creation, but turning to a point of gluttony where we're just devouring everything in sight kind of thing. And Kincaid invites us into that kind of go ahead and fulfill your desire mentality. And an artist that I think is confronting this issue of desire that we find expressed in kitsch is a contemporary artist named Jeff Koons. And Jeff Koons had a retrospective just recently, this past fall, at the Whitney Museum of Art. I don't know if anybody saw that retrospective. And here we have a sculpture, and I've brought in two slides of it that you can see it from two sides. The sculpture is called Pink Panther. And the sculpture is loosely based on a photograph that Koons found of a Italian porn star turned actress turned politician and this toy animal. And from the one side, this figure reminds me a lot of like Mary Magdalene or that kind of woman, and so you have this kind of expression of desire and of self-expression, and then on the other side, the panther seems to be the opposite of her. Like when you look at their faces, like her face is happy, but it seems entirely vacant, versus the panther, there's some way in which Koons has been able to shape the eyebrows of the panther and the way the eyes and even the mouth. This panther to me is so expressive. And the thing that I really love about this sculpture is the way in which the panther is hugging her. Because if you think about it, the panther is actually an inanimate object. The panther is a stuffed animal. So you would think that the panther's limbs would just be hanging by gravity, right? If the panther is not alive, the arms would just fall down. But Koons has composed it so that the panther is hugging her and, if you will, forgiving her, embracing her. This interaction between a figure and what would seem to be an inanimate object is also in Jeff Koons' Bear and Policeman. And here's a picture that kind of gives you a sense of the scale. So when you're looking at the work, the policeman is more or less life-size, right? And so, again, this is based on a kitsch figurine. And so you have this, you know, British bobby, as they're called, the British policeman, and this kind of seemingly friendly bear kind of embracing each other. And your first kind of thought is like, oh, that's so cute, you know. But the more you look at this sculpture, as with many of Koons' works, the sculpture turns very ominous. Because the more you kind of look at that bear's face and his eyes and his mouth, he's kind of threatening a little bit. And then you notice that the bear has his one hand on the policeman's shoulder, but the other hand, he's taken the policeman's whistle, right? The policeman's whistle is his authority, right? The policeman blows his whistle and the cars go, or the policeman blows his whistle and the cars stop. The whistle is the evidence of the policeman's authority, and the bear is taking it away. And in a passage of what I think is just pure sculptural genius, notice how the policeman's body is actually going into the bear. Like, because it's an actual sculpture made out of wood, so in the policeman actually doesn't have a right arm. The policeman's body is going into the bear, which is an indication of what's going to happen next, right? That the bear is going to eat the policeman. And so what Koons is able to do in a work like this is he's taking the iconography of the kind of kitschy world that we live in, that, you know, that is all around us, and exposes its ominous dimension, the way in which, you know, basically what he's saying is if you feed the bear, it will eat you, right? If you feed your kitsch desire, it will eat you.
I just had a thought to, you know, because both a helpful comparison to think about too is if Kincaid is making work that qualifies as kitsch and Koons is too, you know, what's the difference between those? And we've kind of already discussed that, but, you know, Kincaid's work would actually work and be successful if the houses were on fire. You know, because, like, then there'd be some kind of truth that was being told and some kind of, like, dear God, like, this is not a reality that can exist. And because it's not, it's going to burn up here in a minute.
I guess the one thing I would say with Koons is that Koons is not making kitsch any more than Van Gogh is making trees. Like, Van Gogh's subject matter is figures in landscapes and trees. Koons' subject matter is kitsch, but Koons isn't making kitsch any more than Van Gogh is making trees. The last work that I wanted to talk about today before we get into questions and stuff is a work by Anselm Kiefer. And those of you who went on the tour yesterday, we saw this work. And I brought in a couple of slides. This is a very bad slide off the internet, but I wanted to give you a sense of its scale, right? So you can see it's a very large work. But then also, when you get up close to it, it's a very densely painted work. Like, the paint is like clumps on the surface. It's really thickly painted. And so then, going back to the whole work, one of the things that we discussed when we were there in the museum was how this painting engages in a kind of transformation. And this is an experience that really only works when you're in the presence of the painting. But when you look at this painting from a distance, the painting reads as a landscape moving away from you, and an expanding landscape. But the closer that you get to the painting, the form at the center becomes more of a flat and then vertical kind of pyramid shaped. And so what the painting does is it engages in a kind of, to use a term from the conference, a kind of absolution of moving you, that work of art moves you from existing in a sort of temporal, horizontal, timeline-based conception of reality into a vertically oriented, eternity-oriented conception of reality. And I think, again, that's what Kincaid's art never does. Kincaid's art says, it's okay to be here, versus Kiefer's art says, things are not all right here, but there's hope that we can sort of flip the painting, that the situation can be flipped from this temporal experience of suffering and sin into a vertical experience of grace and deliverance.
Something else about the artist of this work also, Kiefer, is that he's a German artist, and he's very much working out of the context of a post-World War II Germany, where the Holocaust is still kind of weighing heavily as a horrible, true event that occurred in his culture's history. So this painting in particular, I think, embodies not only a sense of kind of grief and despair and longing for absolution from such an atrocity as what happened during World War II. But it's hard to see in this slide, but there are, we're seeing a road that, what looks like a road in kind of a desolate landscape, but covered over the entire work also are poppies, flowers. And so there's this, you know, where Kincaid would actually represent in his work this sort of sense of like everything is perfect and nothing has ever been wrong. Kiefer embraces the fact that like there is both death and life at the same time, and it's painful, but it's also beautiful, and out of that, I think, comes this sense of hope for absolution. But he doesn't give us the answer, and I don't think art necessarily its job should be to do that. If you wanted to add anything to
that's
that,
James, good. Why don't we open it up to everybody else?
All right, so I have no idea what anyone's thinking out there, but that was our presentation, and we have some time now for questions or responses or comments or criticisms. Go easy on us. I don't know what time we're supposed to finish, but why don't we just open it up if anybody has a question or a thought?
Yes, sir.
That's right. I'll just repeat that for the benefit of everybody. The comment was that Kincaid's work kind of denies the reality of anthropological truth theologically, that we're actually in a much worse state than Kincaid even allows us to kind of view, whereas Bacon's work embraces that truth and shows us that the ugliness and the pain of that. His view of anthropology is quite low, which means, you know, our ability to save ourselves, or, you know, how bad, you know, what condition is my condition in, to quote the Big Lebowski. Any other thoughts or questions?
Yes.
Naya. You raised your hand, right? Okay.
Hi.
Sure. So the question is, what is art? What makes art good or bad? What qualifies as art? What doesn't qualify as art? And can anyone do it? How much time do we have? We got like 2 minutes. We can do that. Just kidding. I'll do a very kind of asinine thing and throw that to James right away and then comment on it with my own thoughts afterward.
Sure. Well, the one question, can anybody do art? The answer to that is yes, right? Anyone can make art. I think that there's also, just like in every kind of activity, like, sports, right? I can play basketball, right? I can bounce the ball and throw it, but like, no, the NBA hasn't called me yet. I'm short, I'm slow. I don't understand what the problem is. I think everybody can make art, and I encourage people to make art. But then there are just people amongst us who have a special ability for it, who their special talents, whether they recognize it or not, from God, is to be able to work material. Because I guess the answer to the other question is, what makes something art? I think for me, what makes something art is when the artist is able to take material, whether we've looked at a lot of painting here, but whether that's working with paint or working with marble or working with material, and be able to draw out of that material meaning, to be able to move that material in such a way that meaning is communicated.
Yeah, anything I have to say about the subject is coming from my learning from James, so I'm really just an echo here. But and the fact is that, what makes something art versus something that's not art, I don't think is actually the right question. I think that anything can qualify as art, but the proper question, it really comes down to, is this art good or is it not? I do also think, though, that the kind of the pivotal delineation between is this issue of truth, and is this art speaking the truth or is it not? And I would say that if it's not telling the truth, it would not qualify as art. It might be kitsch, as we saw a moment ago.
To sort of build on this, like, what makes a work of art good art? I guess I would connect that to the two things I already was saying about the material and the meaning. And often when I look at a work of art and I think to myself, this is not a good work of art, it's usually for one of two reasons. One, the artist didn't use the material well. The artist didn't either understand the material, the artist was forcing themselves on the material, the artist wasn't loving with the material. In some way, the artist didn't work with the material in the right way. Or perhaps both, the meaning isn't there. There's a lot of art that's about meaningless things, and you ask yourself, so what? The artist is going on and on and on about the work is about this and that. You end up asking yourself, like, existentially, so what? What's really at stake here, right? So when we're looking at Kiefer or Kincaid, Kiefer or Koons or Van Gogh, like, there's something at stake in their work that's not at stake, so to speak, in Kincaid's work.
This might be a reach, but I kind of think one way you could connect the Christian narrative to this idea of whether artwork is succeeding or not. If your material is righteousness, then, like, Christ actually functions as the most successful form of art that there is. What does the work of art look like if the material to be used to express that is righteousness? It's actually a savior that comes to you to save you, because you're not actually that great work of art. Because you can't save yourself.
And kind of speaking along those same lines, Vincent van Gogh actually said that Christ was the greatest artist. And what he meant was that Christ's work of art is this whole creation, the whole package, and the way in which God is working through creation to his glory. He was saying that Christ is, in fact, the greatest artist, because he's able to take something that's broken and make it work.
Yes, back there. Warner Salmon. You're welcome. That's right, yeah. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? In the front here, and then we'll move to the back. Yes, sorry, yep. Absolutely. I don't know if I can fully remember everything you just said, but the I guess the what you were just saying is kind of the idea that that Bacon's ability to depict kind of the truth through this brokenness, and kind of often a lot of his paintings depict these people that are deformed or kind of falling apart. Could you just kind of say it again, what you just said about that? That's right. There's a direct link between the representation of the idea and the material itself, yeah. We had a hand in the back there, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I can see that, yep. Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. And real quick, if you want to learn more or have an interest in art history, James has a YouTube page that has a number of lectures that you can watch. Do you want to speak a little bit about that, James?
Or? You can just tell them about it.
Later. Okay.
10-minute videos.
10-minute videos about specific works of art, comparing and contrasting. And is there a link to it?
If you just go to YouTube and do Seeing Art History, that's the name of the page.
Okay, so go to YouTube and type in Seeing Art History, and you will find it if you are interested in learning more. So thanks again for coming, and we'll see you this evening.